Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns. I was able to do something amazing a few weeks ago. I was able to experience time travel. I went down to a lake in Tayside and I was able to reach out with my fingertips over 400 years and to touch the marks, the gouges made in a tree by wild beaver. That's something that no one has been able to do for over 400 years. That's a wonderful thing, I think. My guest today has been a campaigner for the beaver for many years, and he's just published a book, Bring Back the Beaver. And I'm very proud to have on Outside In, Derek Gow. Welcome to Outside In, Derek Gow.
Good morning. Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Ah, it's great that you're here. And, you know, as I say, I think it's wonderful that in Scotland we have wild beaver once again. Where did your interest in the beaver begin?
Well, my interest in beavers began a very long time ago, about a quarter of a century ago. I'd been working on a captive breeding program for water voles, and with a view to reintroducing them, which we were able to begin to do in the early 2000s. But at that time, you know, it was becoming abundantly obvious to anybody who thought that the open, sunny habitats that water voles required were not environments that they could engineer for themselves. And therefore, you know, we were digging ponds, cutting down trees, slashing back bramble, whatever else, to create these kind of reed and sedge-lined living environments for water voles. But there must have been something doing it before us. And as soon as you start to think that way, and you start to look at the ecology of the other animals that were once here, it became quite abundantly obvious that it must have been the beaver. And at the time, there were no European beavers, the species that was once found in Britain. Actually, I should have said Eurasian beavers, because they were the species that was once found in Britain were distributed from Britain right the way through to China, up to the Arctic Circle, and down probably to the rim or the upper rim of the Mediterranean. And there were none in captivity. The species had become extinct in Scotland, as you say, about 400 years ago, and in England, probably about 200 years ago. They lasted for much longer in Yorkshire, we now know. But there were none in captivity, there were none in the wild, there were a few Canadian beavers in zoos, and there was a lot of talk about bringing the animal back to Britain, and I became involved in looking at technically how it could be done.
Right, right. Now, obviously, as you were in Scotland, the beavers had a twofold release. There was a Scottish Beaver Project, I think it's called, at Knapdale, and that was an official agreed release. And then they sort of, as far as I know, escaped from private collections in Tayside, and have now populated that river system. What difference do you think beaver would make to a river? You know, what would a, because the rivers that we have now are non-beaver rivers. They're not engineered by beavers, and they're very different, I think, from the kind of river systems that we would have if you know, there were wild populations of beaver. What difference do you think beaver would actually make to rivers?
Well, you're right. I mean, in the first instance, they're not the same. They're engineered entirely by us. And people constantly turn around and say, well, you can't reintroduce the beaver. The habitat's changed too much. It's not possible. And in that sense, they are right. The habitat has changed a lot, and it's changed a lot for the better. We no longer want the riparian woodlands. We don't use the alder that grows along the side of the river for gunpowder anymore. The withies that were once so valuable for baskets and creels are now a worthless tree, you know, especially when they're growing in a difficult to extract riparian environment. So the environment we've got, I mean, beavers are a simple animal to live with. They're not an animal of wilderness. They can live in urban spaces. They live today in, you know, massive cities like Munich, on the River Worm, and in Innsbruck, and in Vienna. So the idea that a beaver is an animal of wilderness is nonsense. The difference they make to rivers is that if you're on a big river, which is what the habitat that beavers really like is in big rivers, because they can float up and down the river, digging holes in the bank, feeding on the sedges and grasses and on the woody vegetation that grows along the side, then the difference they make is they put a lot of dead wood in the water, which provides refugia for fish and protection against their predators like cormorants. It mm-hmm. provides living space for crayfish. And also you get trees, dead standing trees on the bank, fallen timber on the bank. They open up the bank side to light. So the trees, which you know might be 30, 40 foot in height when they start, by the time beavers are well established, those trees are coppiced and remain about 4 or 5 foot in height. And of course that mm-hmm. lets sunlight in to the riverbank, which for a whole myriad of other creatures from dragonflies to grass snakes basking, on the stumps of the felled trees that they've left, is the genesis of life. But the real difference that beavers make to riparian habitats is when they move out of the big rivers, and because they want to protect themselves instinctively against predators that are long gone, they start to put in dams and impoundments across smaller streams, and by doing so, they create wetlands which can be vast. And these wetlands are open, sunny, full of plants, full of insects, full of fish, full of frogs. And this animal, in essence, is you can think of it as a great big healer of nature. Study after study that's been undertaken, even in farmlands where virtually all life, even in the soil, has been extinguished, is that when beavers move back into these environments and start to impound water, they return them to life.
I mean, that's an incredible manifesto in a way for the beaver. What I mean, okay, we can see that for the natural world, beaver would make a massive contribution. But what benefit do you think it would have? If I'm a farmer or maybe I live by the side of or close to a river in a town. What benefit would be to communities, to people?
Well, the direct benefit to wider society is if you recreate nature sponges in the valley bottoms, then this catastrophic flooding, you switch on the news today, you look at what's happening, you look at the water horsing down from the hills and the bare lands and the croplands in an environment where we've destroyed near all the wetlands there are or were. And what's happening as far as wider society is concerned is we have created, through effective drainage, a landscape where this happens every time. What it ensures is that the rain hits the bare uplands or the flat pan soil lands. It comes straight down across the land. There's nothing to stop it. Sheets of water flow into what essentially are just ditches or drains. We can't really call them rivers anymore. They're too toxic and too poisoned. Goes horsing down there, and the first thing it hits is a settlement, and it fills up people's homes and businesses. So the effect, if we actually looked at a re-engineering of the countryside, of creating wetlands which slow the flow of water, which are complex things with, an abrasive surface, where there are trees, because of course in very many parts of Britain there aren't any trees anymore, then these trees slow, check, divert the water. The plants, if you've got beaver dams, the plant structure behind them changes, so you end up with much more retained groundwater, and as a result, much more sphagnum. So the long and short of it is that you let these animals back in to re-establish woodland corridors, which are wet, and there will be a significant impact on the sustainability of the countryside as far as slowing the flow of water is concerned. And that will also, because these big sponges have a dual function, they will also take very many of the pollutants out of the water, and it will create, as the climate warms, it will create a much more durable environment as far as drought is concerned too. So it's very well understood that in North America, when they basically exterminated the beavers, by the late 1900s, beginning of the 20th century, the way you took them out, you basically dried out the valley bottoms, and fires, which had never been a thing in valley bottoms before, then raged right the way through forest systems down into the valley bottom, which was formerly wet, up the other side and off into the distance. So beaver-generated wetlands have a significant economic impact, and could have a significant social impact on the way we live in this island.
That's fascinating. I mean, yeah, actually, too, if you don't mind me saying this, you're a fairly unusual animal yourself, in that you started life as a farmer, and you're now an environmental campaigner. Now, that's an unusual transition, and it certainly highlighted in the press. The kind of image we get in the press is that the farming community I kind of seem to feel that anything, any natural animal, anything living out there, badgers or whatever, it's almost as if farming and wildlife are opposed to each other. What made you make that transition?
Gradual understanding that what I was doing was wrong. And it's quite clearly that. I mean, if you look at the history of farming, well, farming has enabled us to build civilization. It's yes. got us from being troops of hunter-gatherers at relatively low densities to cities to where we are now with, you know, a run-up approach of 10 billion people going to be present on this planet by whatever time. And it's made us what we are. But the planet's creaking. It cannot possibly support the draw that we are putting, we are imposing on its resources in so many ways. And, you know, depletion of the soils through, constant use of chemicals and with no goodness, no humus, no dung, no material going back into the soils to sustain them properly, to ensure the microbes and the mycorrhizal fungi and the soil invertebrates are there. You know, we know that we're basically exhausting the planet's resources fast, and that this is leading to, it's not even leading to ecological collapse. I mean, you start to look at the figures that are bandied about now, you know, something like 95% of the vertebrate life on this planet is us and our domestic animals. So when you turn on the TV in a Sunday evening and you see the last of the elephants or the last of the tigers or lions, then that's what you're looking at. You're looking at animals that are marking time, you know, in an inevitable slide towards extinction. Mm-hmm. And in Britain, because we drive through a countryside that's green with hedges and an odd tree, we look out the window of our car, and we assume that all is well here. And it's really very far from being that. The lights are going out here very, very quickly. Yes. The glowworms, the partridges, the curlews, the water voles. It's very hard to look at any guild of species and say that this is now truly working well. And if, you know, so we are really at a crossroads here. We have the last of the last left. What are we going to do now? And if we're going to heal and repair sustainably, then we absolutely need to look at our own attitudes with regard to tolerance and understanding and start to reconfigure our response to nature when it causes us, you know, odd hiccups and problems. And the beaver is the quintessential example of that. Mm-hmm. You know, every time a wild animal species in the past and today, when you look at badgers, you know, can conflicts with our interests in any way, our sole response pretty much is death. Whether that death is realistically required or whether it's something that's built up by a bunch of big bullies into something that must happen is irrelevant. It's the way that basically we've responded to pretty much everything. And it's simply not a durable prospect looking forward unless we want to end up on a planet with ourselves, rats, a lot of feral pigeons, surrounded by our own dogs and our own excrement, because that's pretty much where we're heading now.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's been, I don't even need to tell you, there's been a massive decline in pretty well all species. But you talk there about, I know, as you know, in Scotland we do have wild beaver, and one of the challenges we face is how we manage that conflict between farming interests and the interests of the beavers Beaver are a protected animal in Scotland, but about 90 beaver, I think, have been shot so far because you can get a license to shoot beaver if necessary or if it's deemed necessary. I think the problem is essentially is that we have to grow food somewhere, but much of the high quality arable land is on floodplains, and that's exactly where beavers like to build their dams and flood. And I was wondering, how do you see that being managed, that conflict, or is it a conflict?
Well, of course it's a conflict. How do I see it being managed? Well, I think very many mistakes have been made. the establishment of the beavers in the floodplain of the Tay, I think it's fair to say it's the kind of landscape where you're going to have the worst of conflict with them, because they are going to punch holes in those old flood walls, which were never designed to prevent burrowing animals coming from the water. And by doing so, you're going to get flooding of crops. But at the moment, when you look at the size of Britain, which is a vast island, there might be somewhere in the region of maybe 1,500 to 2,000 beavers in the whole island. And there are many environments, for example, those in the west, where there are no arable crops. It's too wet. There are no flood walls. And in a green environment, if you have trees in lower valley bottoms and river systems or stream systems working their way through them, and the principal agricultural usage above that is grazing, then the beavers present no issue to anybody. They will do a lot of good and very little harm. And therefore, when you look at the response from the statutory nature conservation authorities, which in fairness came as a direct instruction from the ministers, from Rosanna Cunningham and from Fergus Ewing, then this is a big mistake. Those animals, there should never have been a license system agreed to allow killing. If you look at the video that that was designed by ex-members of the Scottish Deer Commission, it shows you just how wayward their thinking is, how insular, how barbaric, and how out of touch with the wishes of wider society. Children were never consulted about this. Nobody else was. And the whole idea of their approach was to normalise the idea of killing without thinking of any other option at all. And the other option should have been, and now, which are slowly coming into place, is you catch the animals that are at issue and you move them to somewhere where they can do good. In the end, it will mean that in landscapes like Tayside, if there are beavers there, then there will have to be two essential choices. One is you keep the landscapes as they are and you keep on killing. But the second is that you look at redesigning those landscapes to create a buffer strip between nature and water and farming. Because when you look at the pollution maps of the Tay and you look at where the insecticides, the metaldehydes, the pests, the other chemical runoffs are, they are in and solely in pretty much the arable land. And that comes at a cost too. So when you see farmers jumping up and down and going on about what the beavers are costing them, you bear in mind that one arable farm on Tayside, you know, last year I checked the figures, got something like £138,000 worth of taxpayers' money, approximately £40,000 worth of which was for greening and for anti-global warming measures, and they are getting that subsidy from everybody else in society so that they can sustain their businesses and sustain their way of lives. So there will have to, in the end, be a balance between what a relatively small number of people want to do and what's good for wider society in part. And that would suggest that creating this green band through the landscape where nature can reform and where farming moves back is a fundamentally good idea, not just for beavers, but for economic reasons, definitely for flood prevention reasons, and also when it comes to the chemical, the soil leachates, that it basically starts to attend to these issues as well.
I mean, that's a pretty powerful argument. And how I think it's quite difficult for someone perhaps like yourself, or I would imagine it is, in that you've moved from one camp to another. What's the response to you and your ideas from the farming community? I'm wondering whether you get a lot of hostility. I don't know.
No, I don't get a lot of hostility at all. The farming community is by no manner of means a homogenous unit, and there are very many people out there, I can assure you, who know that the time is now right for change, and that change is essential. So yes. Who are incredibly intelligent people. And you know, so we're looking at a restructuring of the farm subsidies, which is long overdue, to one which is a proposed in the 25-year environment plan, whereby you're paid to farm in a way that's sustainable, returning goodness and nutrients and organic matter to the soil, You know, preventing runoff, planting trees, ensuring that a percentage of your owned farmed land is returned to nature, then, you know, taxpayers are paying you already for this. You know, your businesses are quite commonly unviable without this taxpayers' injection of cash, which, you know, at this point in time, you know, you don't have to spend almost entirely on things that are driven by a good or indeed any end result at all. I mean, for example, I get a thing called single farm payment, which is based on what my farm was historically used for in 2005. And that money comes to me for doing absolutely bugger all. How much subsidy do you get? You know, when you look at students relying on their parents to put them through university, how much subsidy do they get? It's ridiculous that farmers get this money for doing pretty much nothing. And it's pretty much ridiculous that when you consider the attitude of some of them who seem to view anybody who gets you know, any kind of support in society, however much they need it, as a scrounging you know, benefit monger, that they get this money and nobody ever really twigs the fact that it is in large part for doing not very much at all. So I think, you know, taking that money and saying, right, okay, that's fine, you can have money, but if you're going to have money, you've actually got to do something that's in the interests of all of us, is a very, very reasonable position to adopt. And the intelligent farmers that there are well prepared for this being the way of the future.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think I obviously I live in Scotland and I in the Highlands, and I kind of see what's happening here. And I don't know if it's the same in England, but it feels to me that we are kind of at a tipping point. Things are, you know, certainly in the Highlands, as you know, huge sporting estates dominate the landscape and have done for a few hundred years. And it felt, you know, and obviously they perpetrate obscenities like driven grouse moors, and much of our estates were given over to deer stalking. But it feels as though that is beginning to change. There's a move away from that now, with new landowners coming in, and people's ideas are changing. Do you have the same sense of change from your perspective where you are?
Yes, more and more people are buying land because they want to change their lifestyles. And commonly, these people have no interest that's significant in farming, but do have an interest in nature and its recovery. Now, that doesn't mean they don't want to produce meat in a way that's more sustainable, grass-fed meat, using the old rare breeds of domestic livestock that are adapted and attuned to this environment and that can produce extremely good food, very high quality pork, beef and mutton off a land that can support them without huge amounts of grain to do so. Because when you look at conventional livestock farming, I mean, it's still incredible. It's something that 70% of the corn that's grown in this country is grown to feed animals, so the animals can get fat quickly. And you know, within a 14-month period, because these big continental cattle are really not designed to live in the kind of landscapes that we've got. So, you know, farming is changing. There are people coming into the industry with very different ideas, and that's good. But within the industry too, there are also a lot of people who are looking to the future and who realize that this has to be done differently. Because if we're going to move, you know, from the old cozy confines of the EU into, you know, a true world economy where trade deals with people like the United States of America are frankly all but inevitable, because we need to have those trade deals to basically justify the position we've taken with regard to Brexit, then you're looking at, you know, the deregulation of an agricultural system of standards, the likes of which we've never seen before. Yes. We're looking at imports coming in, which will undermine near complete the productivity of farming in this country. And the only niche market there will be at the end of this, you know, for people who wish to farm and manage land, is going to be this high-end market. It's going to be that you produce things that are genuinely good for nature and you don't lie about it, that are high quality, that people can respect, and that people will buy because they feel they wish to support you in your endeavours. At the moment, that market is not yet here. But it's to be hoped that if the situation does change, or in any case, that market will come.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating time. Tell me a little bit about the book. Your book is rather unambiguously titled "Bring Back the Beaver." Tell me about what you've written in that book.
Well, before we chat about that, there were a couple of other titles proposed. So from a Scottish point of view, I wanted to call it Broadtail because, of course, the old Scottish word for the beaver was Lost Loidan, which is the Broadtailed Otter.
I didn't know that.
From Gaelic to English. And then when we were just kicking names about, the other one that was quite funny was the idea, because they have this, they do this tail slapping warning call on the surface of a lake or pond, as we called it, slappers. But that idea was fairly quickly extinguished by the publicists for the company, so it died a death early on.
Oh, well.
But the book's got very little to do about beavers, to do with beavers. I mean, if you want to buy a book that tells you all there is to know about beavers in detail, then we published a handbook in 2016 called The Beaver, the European Beaver Husbandry Manual, and that goes into them some detail. And a colleague of mine will be publishing a gigantic, tedious tome shortly, which will tell you everything you could ever want to know about beavers, and we'll probably sell 6 copies to the general public. But at the end of the day, it's a story. It's about, so when you start off in nature conservation, or indeed in life, you know, you have no idea as to how things realistically function. And I mean, I attended Gerald Durrell Zoo in 1990 in Jersey, and we sit down and we look at the IUCN guidelines and how these apply to species and the strictures that come with them. And you think, well, that's all quite sensible. I'll tell you what, we'll start to put applications in to release beavers or whatever other species. And as you go on in life, you realise actually that's not the way the game works at all, that these rules are made to ensure that when you start to play the game, you will definitely lose, irregardless of what you do, irregardless of what science there is behind you, irregardless of everything, you will definitely never be allowed to do what you want to do. Because at the end of the day, the old, powerful, you know, deeply conservative land-owning mm-hmm. interests will ensure that what you wish to see happen never will. I think that's changing too. I think there's been a huge sea change in this. Yes. But the beaver and the restoration of the beaver has been a quintessential part of that. Because at the end of the day, despite the considerable commitment shown by SNH to get the project license in Knapdale and to pursue that for the best part of 20 years to the point where they're unable to release beavers there, it's been the releases of animals elsewhere without licenses that have changed everything. Because for the first time ever, what's happened is that people in communities, because these beavers are living at the bottom of their gardens and felling their granny's Lalandii, have been asked to come to public meetings and tell people what they want to do with these animals. And when those people, those children, those old people, those postmasters, those gardeners, those electricians have gathered in a village hall at night and expressed an opinion, they have said, we want the beavers to stay. And the people who sit in closed meetings, and this includes nature conservationists, who conspire to see no end result and who make decisions without ever talking to anybody about how they feel about it, have been completely thwarted by it. So it's been an interesting social exercise as well, because it's empowered people, and because it's produced an end result that's tangible and is not just a huge pile of paper that's going to be shuffled up one day and put in a cupboard to rot. So the beaver process, and that's what's in the book, along with the swearing and the ups and downs, is one that sort of is a social and attitude change. It shows you really in the end, you know, how when a system's broken, the only way you can do something is to commit yourself to ensure it's done, regardless of what it takes to do it, and that perhaps what the end outcome might be. So that's the kind of story that's in the book.
It sounds fascinating. Is there anything you want to say? Or
I think the one thing I would want to say is that, you know, when you actually make a mistake as big as saying, I'll tell you what, the only way there is to deal with these hiccups that beavers present us with is to kill them, and you don't look at the well thought through regimes that are in Europe or North America, which propose alternatives that are written in English and you can quite clearly pick up and read, is that that's your yawning gap in understanding is massive. But from your initial mistake others follow very rapidly that once started are incredibly hard to reverse. So, for example, there is now an emerging economy on Tayside whereby people who kill beavers want to kill beavers because they're paid to kill beavers. And as soon as you get to that stage where you have these, frankly, ignorant, determined, gurtle little sorts going out with a gun to deal with them that way, then you're right back to the historic parallel, you know, with you know, the scalps being paid for penobscots by the British authorities in the 1700s in North America. It's just the same thinking. And stopping these people who have that kind of mentality is a very difficult thing to do. So what you must do at the beginning as a rational thinker, when you start a process at this, is say no. And then in the end, accept it will probably come. But when it comes, it should come on the same basis as it comes in Germany, with government managers who are utterly dispassionate, killing them only when they have to. You do not give a gun to people who hate and allow them to take that hate out on their victim. That is a huge historic mistake. And it's one in Scotland, I am sure, that we will all live to regret.
Thanks very much, Derek. Let's hope that that message gets out. That's a very clear message, and it's been fascinating talking to you. And you know, I do think we're at a wonderful point now. Things are changing. It's going to be painful, I guess, for some people, but we are getting there. And there's a different vision about for our landscape. So, and I understand you're also now looking at the possibility of returning the wildcat to England. Is that correct? Are you doing that?
We've got some meetings coming up shortly, and we're hopeful at these meetings that we're going to be able to set a time scale to this.
Right.
And we are start moving on fairly sharpish, because, you know, the only thing that ever happens in life if you wait long enough is that you die, and everything you wanted to do in life is simply impossible. So unless you've got a time scale, and even if it fades and fails a bit, and you say we're going to work to this, you never make a start. So we're hopeful for Wildcats that we're going to be making a start very, very soon.
On that message, thanks very much, Derek. It's been a pleasure interviewing you.
Thank you very much.